From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. What is the state of humanistic scholarship in the United States? How does scholarship in the humanities extend beyond academic to popular audiences? Is there a politics of culture in America? Soundings put those and other questions to the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. William Bennett was appointed by President Reagan to the chairmanship of the National Endowment for the Humanities in December 1981.
Well, it's a very mixed picture, I'd say. In some ways, it's like a lot of things in America. American scholarship is in some ways like American music, American restaurants, American television. I mean that in this way. We have more of it. We produce more of it. We have a range of quality from excellent to not so good, just like in those other things. The best American scholarship is among the best in the world. And there isn't a topic or an issue or a field or a subject in the humanities that Americans are not prominent.
There's a lot of people going around apologizing for the humanities. How do you measure yourself in that?
Well, I would never apologize for the humanities, and I wouldn't never apologize for American contributions to it. Again, you take our leading scholars in various fields, and they are going to be world-class scholars. But the main point I'd want to make again is we simply produce more scholarship than does any other country. I heard the other day that we produce more journals of scholarly learning in the United States than does the rest of the world combined. But let me get back to my comparison. But like American restaurants, where we have some of the best, we also have some of the worst. We produce so much, it's almost inevitable that would be the case. We support at the NEH, we support conferences. This is just one indication. International conferences. And you don't have a major international conference on any field in the humanities in which Americans are not prominently involved. Field starts, it may start in Paris, it may start in Germany, it may start in the Far East. Before too long, Americans are involved in it and distinguishing themselves in it.
Tell me about some of the high points and the low points. What kind of complaints do you get from the scholarly constituency that that you sort of work with, answer to, that you're responsible for and care about?
We actually don't get that many complaints. I mean, I think there's a sense that there's always a sense that people would like more. You know, how about more money for international conferences? How about higher subsidies for publications? How about larger amounts of money for fellowships? But I think on balance, people recognize that this government, not only in its policy, but in its program, something like the National Endowment for the Humanities, is very generous. And when you take the contribution of NEH and then, of course, add it to the much larger contribution of the private sector, of the support given to scholars and thinkers by colleges, by universities, by individuals, by corporations, foundations, it's just extraordinary.
Are the complaints that there's not enough money in the humanities good complaints? President Reagan asked for more support from the private sector. Is that happening?
Yes. It looks to us as if it is. It's hard, very hard to measure the exact amount of support that goes to the humanities. The reason for that is most of...
Well, what's the annual budget? Just give me a rough figure.
At the NEH, mm-hmm. Our budget is $130 million. Mm-hmm. When the NEH started in 1966, it was $2.5 million. So even counting inflation or discounting inflation, this is a very substantial rise in support, increase in support.
Just tell me parenthetically, how does that money, if that were a pie, how would you just generally slice it up? Where does it go?
Well, roughly, on the budgets I've been proposing, it goes in roughly equal portions to our division of fellowships and centers. This is mainly to support individual scholars, to support centers for advanced learning, and to support programs of summer seminars for college teachers and now more recently for high school teachers. A division of research, which supports basic work in the humanities, work, production of encyclopedias, bibliographies, collection and distribution of materials essential to humanistic study. Our division of education programs, which supports scholars, teachers at college, university, and secondary level, improvement of curricula, summer institutes, workshops in various fields. Our division of state programs, 52 semi-autonomous programs that are in the 50 states and territories. Let me see if I listed them all. And our Division of General Programs, which supports work in museums and radio, such as this, production, television, and a variety of community activities. So it's pretty evenly distributed.
In all of this, are the humanities elitist? Does it mean that if you do the humanities, that you are discriminating in some sort of a cultural sense? Are you a snob if you are a scholar in the humanities? And do you worry about this as you parcel out this federal money?
Certainly not. You're not a snob inevitably. If you're a snob, it's a function of your own choosing, or perhaps of your own character, or your own lack of it. But let's not equivocate on the term discriminating. Discrimination, in one sense, of course, is an entirely appropriate term. We want people who make discriminations, appropriate discriminations, not invidious discriminations.
Mm-hmm. It's not a dirty word.
No. Discriminating intellect, a sense of standards, a sense of the difference between what's good and what's not so good. What's the old statement? The purpose of education is to teach someone when someone else is talking rot. That means you've got to have the ability to discriminate. But no, there's no reason for people in the humanities to be snobs. Sometimes they are. People in all fields sometimes are. But, you know, I think Plato teaches a good lesson here. We have authority, if we have authority in a particular field or a particular area of competence, not for our own sake, but for the sake of those with whom we work. So if a teacher, scholar, has authority in literature, he should not be a snob about it. He should recognize that authority is there to serve those who don't have that knowledge.
You mentioned education a moment ago. This is supposed to be really a hot topic in Washington these days, all over the country. It's supposed to be the main topic in the political campaigns that are coming up. How does the National Endowment for the Humanities see itself? Does it adopt an institutional educational posture?
Yeah, we've been, I think, very clear about that, Wayne. In fact, I sent a letter to Secretary Bell right after the commission report came out.
This is the report called A Nation at Risk.
A Nation at Risk, right. The report of the Commission on Excellence in Education. Mm-hmm. At the end of that report, the National Endowment for the Humanities is one of the organizations listed. At the end, they say, we call on a number of organizations, and we're one of them, to cooperate, to help in furthering excellence in education in America. Well, we wrote Secretary Bell and sent copies to others indicating the things we'd done in the 18 months that I've been there. And we have a very, very clear posture. This is a clear priority for us, has been for the last 18 or 19 months. We are working much more intensively than we did before with secondary schools. We're working much closer with community and junior colleges. And a new program, which we've received a lot of publicity about, is our program of summer seminars for secondary school teachers. This is where high school teachers from all over the country will go to university campuses, work with great scholars and teachers on texts, the books, the real stuff, for 4 or 6 weeks. Those seminars are going on right now, and they will then return to the classroom. And we hope to teach those books, or at least their teaching will be informed by having studied those books. Teachers are telling us this is great, this is terrific.
Now, I noticed that you emphasize the text, the books, the documents, as set against what?
Well, as set against a lot of the training that teachers have had, many of them in schools of education, where they've been trained in, emphasis has been on methodology, pedagogy, theories and philosophies of education.
You know, well, what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a question of balance. There's some things wrong with some of these areas, but I think the central point we're trying to make is that teachers in the classroom, if they're going to teach a discipline, need to have knowledge of the discipline. And these summer seminars are aimed to at least increase competence in part of an area, a discipline, by gaining mastery of a book. Mm-hmm. And the teachers tell us, now the reports are in, that this is the kind of stuff they need. This is the kind of activity that really helps them, that their education was deficient in its treatment of, if you will, the heart, the center, the stuff of education.
To what end does all of this occur? In other words, we know that philosophy doesn't bake bread, the humanities don't fill potholes. How does this reach the public?
I mean, I think an activity like I've just described reaches the public by virtue of the fact that we're talking to teachers. Teachers are a vehicle to the public. If those students, for example, out there in our nation's public and private schools aren't the public, I don't know who is. NEH for a long time has had a reputation as being a preserve of higher education of the scholarly community. I think we've made some moves, adopted some policies which make it plain that that's not the case. The humanities are too important, I think, to be preserved or reserved only for the scholarly community. After all, in the humanities, we gain some sense of our legacy, of our heritage, the meaning of civilization, the best that's been thought and known, as Matthew Arnold said. It's my notion that every citizen born in a decent society such as ours ought to have at least minimal exposure to the humanities. It's a term going around, computer literacy. I'm sure you've heard it. We'd like to propose at NEH, if you will, basic or minimal cultural literacy. And minimal cultural literacy would involve some exposure to literature, philosophy, and history.
One of the recent developments in scholarship in the humanities has been pretty much a straightforward attack on the whole idea of a received canon of knowledge, of a set of standards. You used words like quality and standards. How does the federal government, in the form of the National Endowment for the Humanities, respond to this type of criticism? And then that comes both from within the academy, and it receives a lot of support from outside.
Well, we respond to it every day and in different ways. I have my own personal response. I've written on this, and I think that, frankly, a lot of the attacks on the canon are, and there is a canon, I believe, are groundless and mistaken. But you're not going to prevent this kind of criticism, and you don't want to. And part of the liveliness of the activity in which we're engaged is that it's subject to constant criticism, constant reinvestigation. It's just my sense that the canon, the great works, can withstand that criticism. It's the sense of others that that's not true. But the point that I would want to make about the canon and its tinkering with it or changing it or throwing it out is that if new fields or new subfields arise, as seems always to be the case in the humanities, it strikes me that there is a burden of proof. If they want to replace Shakespeare or Chaucer or Dante, that they have to explain to us or tell us or persuade us that they're more worthwhile reading than Shakespeare or Chaucer or Dante. if we're just reading those old books because they're old books, I don't think that's good enough reason. I would say that we read Shakespeare not just because he's old, but because he's great, but because he gives us insights into human nature, because we can understand, as one of his critics said, the struggle of good and evil for the possession of a human soul by having read Shakespeare. If someone comes along who can do that better, then let's push Shakespeare to the side. Until that's the case, I think we ought to read him.
But part of the argument is that reading the so-called masters, the great books, is a perpetuation of a kind of a power mold, a kind of a cultural grip that disallows, that disenfranchises certain sectors in the academy and among popular audiences. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think that's nonsense.
Uh-huh.
how could an appreciation of King Lear disenfranchise anybody? I mean, I just want to see that. Just want to see that case made.
Following that up, let's talk about some of the criticism that's been leveled at the endowment in terms of funding of certain projects. Isn't it impossible to avoid the politicizing of culture? That is to say, the making of films, the making of radio programs, but now we're talking particularly about public programs in which there is an ideological or a political posture that obviously some parts of the constituency are going to look at favorably and others are going to condemn. How do you walk that tightrope?
No, I don't think it's impossible to keep the endowment from being politicized, and I think we've done a pretty good job. One thing it requires is for us to speak loudly and clearly when it looks like someone's trying to politicize the agency, and that we've done. But look, most of the work that is done in the humanities is not political, shouldn't be political, and can be judged apart from any kind of political agenda. We just funded a large project on Renaissance music. It's a film on Renaissance music. It's entirely possible to do a show like that without any political interference at all. It's also entirely possible to do a show on political philosophy without serving any particular political agenda. What is the political agenda? You know, you're asking about the media. What is the political agenda of the Lehrer-McNeil report? I mean, I defy anybody to tell me whether that is a left-leaning or right-leaning show. To me, that's a pretty good model of balance. Yeah, any particular show, you know, they may have miscalculated on the guests, and they may have weighted a little one way or a little the other way. But I think the reason that show is so good is that people get a sense they're going to hear on blatantly political topics. Both sides of an issue. I bring that example up not to suggest that that's a kind of model for many of the shows that we do in the humanities, because it isn't, because most of the stuff we do, you know, isn't about current events, isn't about contemporary issues, and shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff we do looks to the past, as is the nature of the humanities. I bring that show up rather as an example to say that one can even take the most burning public issues of the day, political issues of the day, and still keep it from being politicized. One of the features of that show, people watch it, is it has a kind of credibility, has a kind of integrity. Mm-hmm. So, point is, if one can deal with burning political issues in a way that is not political, plainly one can deal with questions in the humanities in a way that is not. So there are a lot of people who do want to become journalistic, who do want to become commentators on the current scene. Some of them you'd like to encourage, some you'd like to discourage, frankly. Going public can mean a number of things. I would like to think of going public as meaning that one seeks a broader audience, a wider audience for what one is saying.
Regardless of the range of ideas, right?
Yeah. One seeks to be, if you will, first of all, intelligible. One mm-hmm. seeks to be understood. One seeks to have people understand and appreciate what it is you're doing. Now, there are some scholars who will tell you what I am doing is so opaque, what I am doing is so complex that no one really will understand it. It just takes so long to get there. Sometimes that's true. And sometimes that's a blessing, and we should bear that in mind. Not every idea. I wouldn't want to stand behind the notion that every idea that a scholar hatches in his study ought to get immediately wide and broad public dissemination. A lot of these things deserve to be buried in the privacy of one's study. But where work is good, and where work is interesting, and where work illuminates questions or issues or ideas or events that people are concerned with, fine, by all means, get it out. We encourage that in all the ways that I think our program describes. Write a book, make a series of radio shows on it, do a museum exhibition on it. Have a series of programs in your state on it. Lots of vehicles.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with William Bennett, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The discussion is about the state of American scholarship in the humanities, the functions and uses of the humanities in American life, and the relationship between politics and culture in the United States. Bill, tell me about what you think. You've been the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities for nearly 2 years. What's the high point? What's the low point? What do you worry about, and what makes you happy?
A lot of high points. I think one of the things that pleased me perhaps as much as anything was when we had our hearings this year. We have a number of hearings every year, but one of our most important hearings is before the House Subcommittee on Appropriations. It's a House committee, so it's chaired by a Democrat, and it's largely a Democratic committee. This, as you know, is a Republican administration. These hearings are often rough and tumble, at least a good tussle. And this was a very good hearing with good discussion, good argument, I thought, on both sides. But the thing that pleased me was that the hearing was conducted with a sense of mutual respect and candor. And afterwards, the subcommittee, Democratic subcommittee, and then the committee, essentially went along with the proposed budget that we had put before them. We are having some debate about the amount, but essentially our arguments about the distribution, about how the funds should be spent, where the funds should go, what priorities are, were accepted. That was a real high point, because I think a lot of people think, a lot of people advise me, that you'd always be in an adversary position, that the committee hearings were an opportunity for the Democratic House to beat up on the Republican administration. Well, we didn't get beat up, and we didn't beat up anybody, but we had a very good exchange of views, and basis, I must say, I think, of our arguments and our performance to date, Our budget, its distribution, the structure of our spending was approved, and that's not the kind of thing that's going to make the front page, but it's an indication of respect. It's an indication of coming to agreement on priorities, even though there are other differences. That was a real high point.
Mm-hmm. Low points?
Oh, low points, I suppose. These are rare, but it's distressing at times to see the evidence of people coming to you in person or on the telephone or in writing, trying to insinuate themselves by way of subtle influence on your decision. Sometimes people from the field, the humanities, occasionally people who stand between brokers, quote, representatives of humanities groups or organizations, and even more rarely, a member of Congress. We have a process at the NEH. The process is a good one. It's review, panel review, peer review by people in the field. And I think it, although it's fallible, and although I disagree with the results of it often, there are things that get funded that I put my name to that I'm not particularly happy about. It's a good process.
Who picks these reviewers? Do you get accused of stacking the deck?
No, I very rarely enter in. When I got to the endowment, I gave staff, which meant I put into the computer, a list of about 100 or 150 people who I thought would make good panelists. That from my experience in teaching and being at the National Humanities Center and having met a lot of people. But we leave to the staff, that is, division directors, assistant directors, program staff, two, three levels from me, the decisions about who goes on panels.
Okay, now all of this is internal. You were talking about the Congress. You're talking about the review process. Now, let me ask you to really attempt the impossible. Step outside of yourself. Do you think the endowment is getting the humanities to the American public? Do you think they have any tangible, substantive appreciation for scholarship in the humanities? And is the aim, let me put the question another way, is the aim a question of degree of knowledge about the humanities among the public, or is it subtler than that? You talked about education earlier and teachers.
It is subtler than that. Look, the endowment has many purposes, and getting the humanities to the public, to use your phrase, is only one of them. I mean, the endowment is there to advance scholarship in the humanities. The endowment is there to provide support for the essential resources needed to conduct the humanities, dictionaries, encyclopedias, the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, the Greek Lexicon, the Encyclopedia of the Middle Ages.
Library of America, things like that?
No, I wanted to use those different examples to suggest that those are things, the Greek Thesaurus, the Greek Lexicon, the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, the Dictionary and Encyclopedia of the Middle Ages. These are not things the public is, for the most part, going to get its hands on.
You don't find them in B. Dalton, huh?
No, they're not. They're not on the top of the bestseller list. They're not pushing Garfield around by any means. But nevertheless, they're important. We need them. We need to have them. Why? Because we want to be able to do good scholarship, and we want to be able to have this repository of knowledge of our civilization. But you picked the Library of America. It's interesting. We have supported a number of the books that have come out in the Library of America. That now is getting into broader circulation. Well, what about for the public overall, the general public? Well, let's take some of our programs again in with the secondary schools. If those teachers are better as a result of the work we're doing, then I think that we're helping the public. If we do put on a good TV production or a good series of radio shows, which parts of the public hear, then we're fulfilling another aim of the NEH, which is to foster a better public understanding of the humanities. But we don't exist just to, if you will, sell our wares broadly to the public. We have a number of functions. We're to support individual scholars for their own sake and for the sake of learning, because we believe that makes for a better country, not in a sense that's immediately apprehended by everybody, but it doesn't depend upon it being immediately apprehended by everybody. We think that, you look at the original legislation creating the endowment, as we should be prominent in science, so we should be prominent in other areas. The endowment's there really to recognize excellence, to encourage excellence, and to keep our standards high. I think it does a pretty good job. It's modest. It should be modest. We have not requested increases in our budget. I think we have plenty of money to do our job. It is not one of the most important jobs that government has to do. But as I've said a number of times, if the agency does its job right, if it keeps its skirts clean, it's a justifiable form of assistance, I think.
From your vantage point as the chairman of the NEH, is there a politics of culture? Does it keep you awake at night? Do you worry about it? How does it work?
It doesn't keep me awake at night, but there is a politics of culture in several senses. There's a politics of culture as surely there as there are fashions in culture. Justice Holmes said there are fashions in intellectual life as well as elsewhere. There are politics in culture as there is elsewhere. James Madison, in the 10th Federalist Paper, says a faction is a group of people united by a common impulse of passion. Madison says factions are the essential political fact of life. Are there in the humanities groups of citizens united by a common impulse, passion? Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I have been told, I guess, a dozen times to pay more heed to constituency groups. What I asked was a constituency group, and I was told in Washington, constituency group is a group of humanists who are organized, united by a common body or impulse of passion. I think Madison was right. Well, it's an interesting phrase, constituency group, because actually, technically and legally and appropriately, the only constituency I have, since I am the head of an agency, federal government, is the American people. But there is an attempt, there are constant attempts to influence me, to influence the direction of my thinking and of our funds by various groups in the field, by this community, by that community, by the scholars in this field, the organizations in that field. Now, advice, judgment, criticism is entirely appropriate, and I've asked for that. You'd be foolish to step into this job and not to ask people who've been in it for years for their best judgment. You've got to realize that humanists, like people in the oil business, have representatives in Washington. They have offices in Washington. The only difference is that oil lobbies aren't called oil lobbies or special interests. Humanist groups in Washington call themselves constituency groups. Well, they're special interests. They're factions. They're just the same. They can be just as pleasant, and they can be just as unpleasant and meretricious. but yes, there is politics of culture in that sense. There's a so-called watchdog society in Washington that puts out a newsletter. It is there to make sure that we are doing what we're supposed to be doing. Maybe that's why it's there. Some suspect that it's there to feather its own nest. But yeah, there is politics and culture.
Bill, let me ask you to talk personally for a few moments. What's been the most enjoyable thing that's happened to you as chairman, the most gratifying experience that you've had?
Getting married was plainly the most enjoyable and
gratifying. Did you marry a humanist?
No, I married a teacher, a lady who's doing graduate work in special education. She works with them at about 2 and 3. And I guess where do we work with them in the humanities? Well, maybe as early as 15 or so, but not usually much earlier.
Bill, it's a pleasure to have you back at the National Humanities Center and to have you on Sounding. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a conversation with William Bennett, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mr. Bennett was educated at Williams College, Harvard University, and the University of Texas. From 1979 through 1981, he was director of the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me for a conversation with the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. William Bennett discusses the state of American humanistic scholarship, the functions, uses, and audiences of the humanities in the United States, and the politics of American culture. William Bennett was appointed by President Reagan to the chairmanship of the National Endowment for the Humanities in December 1981. American Scholarship and the Politics of Culture. Listen for some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.